Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, y'all. Wake up now. You know, it's funny that they put me up here after Julie. She's like, this is my city. I'm sitting there thinking, no, honey, this is my city. Because up until September, as they said, I actually lived in Chicago. I'm born and raised here, and I love it. I always love to have a fellow colleague from the city of Chicago here, because so much about Chicago, as she outlined, is about zip codes. I, in some ways, can tell you a tale of two cities. Having come from a family, my grandparents migrated to Chicago from Alabama in the second wave of the Great Migration, as so many African Americans in this city did. And I grew up in Austin, a zip code just west of here that has, and it's currently dealing with, an endemic issue of violence in the city of Chicago, something that I was working on right before I left. And I actually, with a couple of my team members, went over to Austin yesterday and sat with a group of young men that later on I will talk about why you should be thinking about this as a health issue that everybody should be focused on and funding. There is no other group of stakeholders where the mortality rate would be so high in a concentrated group, and we wouldn't be focused on figuring out how to end those deaths. So that's something that we're going to talk about today because it intersects with criminal justice and health. So thank you for having me here. I want to thank Faith and the team at Grantmakers in Health, both for hosting this wonderful event, for inviting me to speak to you, for doing it in my hometown, and for having the courage to see the intersection between criminal justice and health. I joined the foundation in October, on October 2nd, 2017, and in March, we launched a new special opportunity that we're calling Race, Redemption, and Restoration. So much of what this work is for me is a critique on something that's happening at the national level in philanthropy. Now, I know for all the folks in this room, this is just an issue that we're struggling with, and everybody else has licked this, but I'm gonna talk about it just in case some of you get some value in it. One of the things that I see having come back into philanthropy after being a practitioner for years is that sometimes what happens in philanthropy is that at the national level, there's a huge gulf between the work that we're funding and what's happening on the ground. And that actually can often be true even if you're working at the state level. And one thing we have to do as philanthropists is make sure that we're first doing a better job of partnering with state and regional foundations that are closer to the ground and actually will be the ones that stay the course after our initiative ends and we pull out of a jurisdiction, but we also all have to ensure in our work that the folks that we actually put on our websites, the people whose faces and stories we tell in our pamphlets, actually show up in the work. Because what I've seen oftentimes as philanthropy is that the very people we talk about and whose stories we use actually end up being unseen in the leadership of the fields that we pursue. And I think that's a problem, because any grant-making strategy should offer agency to the people we purport to be helping, saving, and working on behalf of. And that's what this initiative is about. When I went to my board just 15 minutes after getting there, I know they were like, Lord, where do we get this child and how do we send her back? I said to them, one of the things that I think is so extraordinary about the field of philanthropy is that for all intents and purposes, we should be disconnected from anything. We don't have to deal with partisan politics. We're closed dollars. Should is a phrase that I use because sometimes I still do think that to get in that governor's ball or to sit at the seat of power, we compromise a voice on behalf of the communities we need to represent. But that's something that we all have to be extraordinarily sensitive to. We can do a good job as a field of holding up a mirror to the world. One thing that I caution everyone to always do in this work is every now and again, just flip that mirror around and take a look in it and see what we're doing, because philanthropy sometimes drives inequities, right? We have a lot of power, and after these meetings, folks always rush up to me, Candace, how do I focus on structural racism and racism in my work? And I say, before you go out and look to take on some massive system, One of the best ways to deal with racism is to focus on the thing that you have the most control over, which is your grant making. If there are inequities in how your dollars rush out of the door, if your partners and the people that you fund are not as representative as the communities as they should be, before you tackle any structural system, tackle that, okay? So that's just preemptive before y'all run up here. That's something that I'm gonna say to you because as a field, it's something that we really have to deal with. What we did in our work is talked about how we're gonna get closer to the ground at the Public Welfare Foundation. And the way we wanna do that is making sure that we're funding people who are impacted. We work on youth justice, adult criminal justice, and workers' rights. And one thing I said is, in addition to funding national and state level advocacy organizations, how many of the organizations we work on are led by returning citizens? How much work do we do on systems of scale that are about employing and giving voice to the people that are impacted by those systems? And that's something that we're gonna be focused on more and more moving forward. We also, as you all already know, have to get comfortable giving general support to organizations so they have the latitude to do work and respond to issues, and multi-year support. So they're not spending all their time coming back to us, writing reports and raising money, but they actually have some time, space, and bandwidth to focus on the work. Our mission is to advance justice. And if there's any organization in this room where there's any word like race, equity, fundamental fairness in your mission, what I said to the board and our team is that those words demand a great deal of care and actually not just saying them, but how we operationalize and live them in our work. And so that's something that we're doing to ensure that we respond to the growing need of systems and supports in communities happening on the ground. We kicked it off with what was essentially a conversation. We do not presume that in a windowless conference room in Washington, D.C., which is where we're based, we have all the answers. We invited stakeholders in from all over the country, our partners. We had a conversation with them about ways that we might think about this, and we're continuing those conversations as we actually start to make grants. Over time, people keep asking me, where do you go with this? This right now is a special opportunity. It's a project out of my office at the foundation. And what I said is that over time, if we're doing our grant making right, this doesn't need to exist. Special opportunities that are looking at proximity to the people that we work on cannot continue to be a special initiative. They're ultimately going to have to be baked into our grant making writ large. And so as we embark on our strategic planning, we are making this focus the pillar of how we do our work moving forward. Race. Now we turn to the systems that we focus on. And if you work in criminal justice, it's actually pretty striking to be able to show the racial inequities in that system. But I imagine for many of you, there are also striking inequities, as Julie outlined, in the health systems that you work on. There is clear disparity in who ends up in the justice system, and there have been lots of debates over time. Years ago in Seattle, there was a Supreme Court justice who said, well, people of color end up in the system because they offend more. And there was outrage because research actually shows that when you control for offending rates, it doesn't actually show why certain people end up in the system at greater rates. So that's an issue that we have to focus on for race in the criminal justice system. We know that racism has behavioral and physical health outcomes, increased anxiety, all kinds of things that are simply related to health for the communities and individuals that constantly feel like they are under structural racism. There was a report released last year that looked at racial disparities in plea bargainings. So when prosecutors are offering to individuals a way to plea down a case, they control for folks who had similar backgrounds and folks who were basically being charged with the same offense, and showed that whites were 25% more likely to be offered a plea for a lower charge than blacks. What's interesting about this study is that there was greater disparity for low-level offenses. Isn't that interesting? The reason that is because when there's greater discretion, when there's less of a background or a less serious offense, prosecutors were more likely to offer white defendants a plea. But when it's more serious, right, there's less discretion overall because of the nature of the charge. There was more consistency in the charges, though there were still small disparities. We also saw that in 2004 in New York City, for men of color going out for low-wage jobs, there were disparities between white, Latino, and African-American males. White males were more likely to get offered a job in New York City, and interestingly enough, this study showed that when white men with felony backgrounds went out to get a job, they were still more likely to be hired than a black or Latino male with no background. Now, we know from Maslow's hierarchy, one of the things that you need, a health consideration, is to feed your family. But if systemically we are making it impossible for whole communities to be able to do that, we contribute to some of these issues that ultimately will have impacts on health. Taking us back to philanthropy, there are also just field-based disparities that we create. A report last year looked at, over the last 10 years, which I thought was really striking, 10 years ago, they looked at the amount of diversity in philanthropic leadership, CEOs and boards. 10 years later, the rate had not changed 1%. It's less than 20% of leadership. And when you look at the leadership of social justice organizations, it's almost the exact same percentage as the leadership in philanthropy. There is no controlled experiment for why that is, but I'm going to speculate that one of the issues happening is that we fund people that remind us of ourselves. And that's one of the reasons why when we embarked on this race redemption work, talking about getting more proximate to communities and ensuring we're getting agency, we want to be really intentional. I'm a slick little urban lawyer who went to NYU Law. My whole portfolio cannot be represented by people that look like me, even if I'm a person of color. I have to be hyper vigilant and ever intentional about ensuring that the people in that portfolio are truly diverse. And that's a challenge that we all have to tackle in a field. If we don't want to be contributing to those racial health-based outcomes that we saw on a slide earlier. The second part of our work is all about redemption. Now, this was a slide that when we had our March 9th event, created a lot of controversy. Because for me, it's not always clear whether I'm actually talking about redeeming the people that are coming out of the criminal justice system, or if really what I want is redemption for America, which has created this unique problem of having so many people in its criminal justice system, in part driven by its own racial history. Either way, this is what we named it, and what we're working on is ensuring that as the scale of the problem of the criminal justice system grows in the US, we actually have strategies to address something similar to that scale. For those of you who aren't steeped in criminal justice, a lot of what you'll hear colloquially is people saying there were 200,000 people in the US criminal justice system in the 1970s, and now there are over 2 million people. And when people hear that, they're usually struck by how large that number is in such a short amount of time. The truth is that grossly underestimates the footprint of the criminal justice system in this country. There are more than 2 million people currently incarcerated, but when you add back in those people who were previously incarcerated, you get to over 7 million. Here's another note. A lot of people who are touched by the criminal justice system don't end up in deep in custody. They either serve their time in local jails or end up on probation. And so when you look at the number of people who have a felony conviction in this country, you easily get to over 20 million. The Bureau of Justice Statistics a couple of years ago tried to estimate when you added in misdemeanors and arrest, and noted that in America, the number of people that have had criminal justice involvement is closer to 70 million. That's a problem of scale. And what I'll talk about is that no matter what you think, because we are a country that loves and believes in retribution and accountability, there is a really important outcome for communities, for families, for this nation overall, of making a choice of allowing a problem of this scale to exist and to have a concentrated impact on communities, many of the same communities that you're trying to impact in your work. One of the things that we know in the US is every year, based on lost wages of people who have a criminal background, the country, the gross domestic product of the US, is diminished between $55 or $65 billion. CAP estimated that in a couple years, one in every two children will have a parent with criminal justice involvement. We know this knowing full well the impact on lost incomes in certain communities all over the US, and that there are unique outcomes for children of incarcerated parents. Now, for those of you who do not work in urban jurisdictions, we in America have thought for a very long time that the criminal justice problem was a uniquely urban problem. I caution you to go to the Vera Institute of Justice's website and pull down the report that they released yesterday, because what they're estimating is that the massive growth of criminal justice is now happening in rural jurisdictions all over the country. So if it hasn't hit you yet, it's coming to your backyard. I strongly suggest that as health funders working both in urban and rural jurisdictions all over the country, you think about making this one of your priority issue areas. Criminal justice has all sorts of impact. Years ago, this is from a 2015 study, it showed that 2.7 million children currently had an incarcerated parent. That doesn't include, as we just talked about, those 70 million folks who just have a parent that has some criminal justice contact. For children with a parent who are in the criminal justice system, there are all kinds of adverse childhood experiences. They underperform in school, they're more likely themselves to end up in the justice system, and they have all kinds of behavioral and physical health issues. Black children are 9 times more likely to have a parent in the criminal justice systems, Latinos are 3 times more likely, and white children to have a parent involved in the criminal justice system. So it's concentrated in zip codes and communities all over the country, though increasingly, as I said, there's a growth in rural communities. This study, the ACES study, looks at youth in the juvenile justice system. You guys already probably know this. Our criminal justice system is also, in many jurisdictions, being used to be the behavioral health or substance abuse system that we no longer have in local communities. Oftentimes, youth in the system have a formerly incarcerated parent. They overpresent with special disabilities in learning. They also have behavioral health and other substance abuse issues. I ran for years the Department of Juvenile Justice here. I had more than a few youth who had several prior psychiatric hospitalizations. What that said to me is that at what point in our health system, before we committed that kid to the prison, did we fail them so fundamentally that the only thing that we could do is going from institutional care in psychiatric hospitals to sending them to the youth prison system? I can assure you, jails and prisons are not the best behavioral health system this country has to offer. Another thing to look at that's happening all over this country is for even those folks who are not ending up in custody, we have people that are on community supervision. And a Wisconsin study looked at the physical and behavioral health stressors for people who were just on probation or post-release supervision, showing that those individuals had higher stress, higher anxiety, all kinds of negative health indicators just by the constant threat of losing their liberty. So it has impacts both on children and on adults. We know that for those people that end up in the justice system, there are all kinds of negative health impacts. They're more likely to end up with an infectious disease, higher likelihood of HIV, tuberculosis, Hep A or B. There's a greater risk for all kinds of physical issues, high blood pressure, chronic lung disease. And studies in states have shown that they actually have a higher rate of mortality. 2 years shaved off the life of folks in New York, 50% higher mortality rate for men in Georgia, and 150% higher mortality rate for women in Georgia. What's interesting about that ecosystem is that the high mortality rate is not just concentrated to people serving time. People who work in correctional settings die younger. Studies based on the Correctional Officers Union show that they shave years off the life of the people there. That says something about that environment. If we have a problem in this country where 70 million people are cycling in and out of a system that literally is an environment where you increase the likelihood of infectious diseases, where you have all these stressors that increase negative outcome. And what everybody needs to realize is that most people do not go to jail for life. We send them back to the same communities that are already economically depressed and have an eroded health system. And do you know how we compound that? In many states, we compound it by interrupting their care. What happens in the U.S. is that if you are Medicaid eligible and you go into a state system, you cannot be eligible while you're in that system. And while HHS at the federal level for years has offered guidance to say, we actually should not be terminating coverage of those individuals, we should be suspending it so they can immediately go back out and have coverage when they return to communities. In most states, even though that guidance exists, even in states where there's legislation on the books, operationally, we still terminate people when they go into state custody. So we put them in an ecosystem where we know we're exacerbating all their health outcomes. And then to put a cherry on top, we interrupt their care, throw them out in the community. And we all stand back and say, why aren't these people thriving? What's going on in these communities? One thing as health funders that you can really look at in your local jurisdiction is whether or not you are interrupting care. For a person who used to run a system, it is very hard when you're trying to successfully re-enter a child or an adult into a community. You have stabilized them on meds and everything that they need, and as soon as they leave, because that care is interrupted and you have to re-enroll, it's actually not available to them when they get home. 39 states still terminate, so that means there's plenty of states left for you guys to target if anybody wants to take this on. The final issue that we focused on in restoration, because our foundation focuses both on youth and adult criminal justice, one thing I said to folks, and this is an issue of vulnerability in the field of criminal justice, is that you actually can't talk about the issue of criminal justice reform without dealing with violence. I am from Chicago's West Side, and I own a home on Chicago's South Side. I ran the youth prison system, and I was a huge reformer, reducing the number of youth in custody, closing a youth prison. But one thing I would always say is that it is also not okay when I hop off the train at 9 o'clock and I'm walking to my little house on the South Side of Chicago to walk past the visual of a dead young man. That is also an issue for criminal justice that we have to care about. The truth is that I am not convinced for most of the things that end up in the criminal justice system that that system is the best way to handle it, but that means that we need to have research and demonstration projects on what system or what programs we think at the community level should be responding to those incidents when they occur. And so that's something that we're focused on in this initiative. We know a couple years ago, Chicago was certainly at the epicenter of this, that there was a spike in violent crime. At the first half of last year, the Uniform Crime Report said that there had been a decrease. I think most of that actually is based on what's happening in Chicago. While Chicago is not, contrary to common belief, the highest rate of violence in the country, because of its sheer population size, its raw numbers can drive what happens at the national level. But we were not the only jurisdiction that was dealing with this issue, and part of it is that we need more research about how best to respond to this issue in the U.S. I started here because I was on Austin yesterday. Black men are 13 times more likely than white men to be shot and killed by a gun. What's interesting about this statistic to me is so much in criminal justice, especially when you're a person that sits around law enforcement tables. When we talk about victims in this country, everybody just stop for a minute, close your eyes, and picture a victim. How many people came up with a young black male? Right? When we think of victim, the person that we think of in this country is actually not the person that is highly likely to be a victim. A couple of years ago, the Department of Justice actually issued a report, the Victims of Crime Office, acknowledging that for a long time, black and Latino males have been excluded from victims of crime resources, though they are highly likely to be the victims of violent crime in the U.S. Like I said, for health funders, gun violence is an endemic issue. It is a uniquely American issue. It is something that should be focused on as a public health concern. So I really challenge each one of you to go back to your jurisdictions and offices and think about that. One of the things that I'd like to commend the John and Laura Honor Foundation is just a month ago, they announced a national initiative to study gun violence in the U.S. They have taken the position that they are going to step into the place that the federal government will not, because the CDC is not funding gun violence research in this country, and they're gonna fund it. And they put out a catcall to funders all over the country to stand with them. I encourage you guys to look at what they're doing, to reach out to them, to reach out to us as we think about violence. This is an issue that we can and should be able to get our arms around. promising work that's underway in the local jurisdictions at the intersection of health and criminal justice. The Chicago Police Department is working on training officers on how to respond to mental health issues. There have been some tragic incidents all over the country, but especially in this local jurisdiction, of people presenting with mental health issues being killed when they otherwise probably needed a behavioral health response. And so offering crisis intervention training to local law enforcement is something that they're doing all over the country. There's a really gold standard model that's been done in Denver, but they're also piloting some training locally for police officers, and that's something to watch. There's also a Cook County triage center. As soon as people leave the jail, because so many of those people have substance abuse or behavioral health issues, they have care for them immediately. So instead of cycling in and out of the jail, they can go into the center and immediately get triage services. There's also the pilot of a supportive release center. One of the groups that hosted a pre-conference training event was TASK yesterday here for the Grantmakers in Health. I encourage you to follow their work on any one of these initiatives to understand how in this local jurisdiction they're focusing on the intersection of criminal justice and health. Also recently announced was Illinois is finally the recipient of an 1115 waiver. And I'd like to commend Felicia, who ran for years the HHS system in Illinois. She actually just stepped down from that system. She was a woman that came on years ago and made it her charge to shepherd the state through the final approval of our 1115. Some of the things that are unique about the waiver in Illinois is that it is focusing on moving away from institutional care across all systems of health, because we know in health, in child welfare, and criminal justice, you actually usually aren't getting the best outcomes for people long-term by serving them in big institutions. But to do that, we have to be able to pay for institutions and have a continuum of care in communities, which too often what we do is we pump all our money into big, deep-end systems, and we have nothing left to build a continuum of care in communities where outcomes are better and where the need is greatest. And so that's what this waiver is designed to do here. What's also unique about the 1115 waiver in Illinois is that it actually goes through the continuum and includes justice reform. So many times when they sit down at a table and talk about systems of health, they leave criminal justice out. But from the beginning, the Department of Juvenile Justice, the youth prison system, and the Department of Corrections, the adult criminal justice system, were at the table to figure out what kind of behavioral health and substance abuse and temporary housing treatment could be provided and reimbursed for those individuals as they go back to the communities as well. Another thing to think about is that we've seen that there are good health outcomes related to giving people education opportunities while they're in prison. If we have a 70 million scale people going into the system, we need to be intentional about what happens to them while they were there. There is a demonstration project called Second Chance Pell at the federal level, and what it's doing is reenacting Pell access for individuals in custody so that they can have access to post-secondary education and then transition out. It has been shown that it has positive impacts on all kinds of pro-social things, like getting them jobs, getting them health and housing, being able to provide for their families. And so that's another thing that folks can be thinking on as a policy issue. I wanted to just lay out for you a couple of policy things that you can target. Community-led, community-based programs providing a continuum of physical and behavioral health system. If you guys figure out how to link the problem in behavioral health, I can assure you we'll be light years ahead in criminal justice. Because if we could really create a continuum of care in communities, a lot less people would fall through the cracks and end up in deep-end systems. Advocating for prison-based education and programs in custody to actually get people on track. Trauma-informed care in communities. One of the things they were doing over in Austin for the guys that are highest risk of gun violence is offering them CBT and a job. What I love when they got there is the guys said, we don't call it CBT. Nobody in here is getting therapy. We call it CAD, control, alt, delete. We're gonna control ourselves, alternate our behavior, and delete the bad stuff. And I was like, well, whatever you call it, long as you do it. So I think that's great as health funders to talk about all these ways in criminal justice and in violence, we can do stuff that's fundamentally an evidence-based behavioral health intervention. Trauma-informed training, as I talked about, for law enforcement individuals, decriminalizing drugs, removing barriers from housing and employment, which will shore up the safety net for folks, promoting transparent, accurate data collection on issues including gun violence and policing, and advancing policies that don't terminate Medicaid coverage when people go into custody. I want to leave you guys with a quote. The method, scale, and aim of the justice system must transform to one that works in true partnership with public health, behavioral health, health systems, and communities to create environments of care, prevention, and healing. Only when we recognize that we have a shared foci on this issue are we going to get in front of it. Thank you all so much. Enjoy your time in Chicago.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.